So this morning we come to the end of the material in the Isaiah scroll that comes from Isaiah himself, plus updated, reapplied material from later centuries. Chapter 24 to 27 is a particular section with its own character. It's probably the last part of the Isaiah material to be put in. It's apocalyptic, it seems to belong even to the 3rd century BC. So the opening verse indicates the focus of these chapters, which is on God's final judgment of evil, whatever historical form it may take. We've seen a lot, or we hurried through it, I confess, the judgments of the nations, Moab and Ammon and all the rest of them, we've seen that. This is really about the judgment of the world. This is extrapolating from that to the whole, whatever historical form, God's judgment, what is it? This forms a fitting conclusion to a section that has pronounced the divine judgment against the nations that have acted against God's chosen people. It's a small step to widen the scope of the judgment, to speak of God's judgment of any and every power that proudly acts against the will of God. A scholar called Brevard Childs, in his commentary on Isaiah, speaks of these chapters, 24 to 27, as, quote, divine admonition and encouragement to a community of faith living under great pressure and struggling to discern in its historical experiences the ways of God in human life. And the authors of this material, drawing on Isaiah, of course, they've been through Persian control and then, of course, the Greek. And here they are, a small little Judah, we'll talk about it later, small little Yehud as part of the Western satrapy of the Persian Empire, and then the Greeks coming. There's no hope of them ever getting independence, they would think. So they're looking to God to do something, because they're in a hopeless situation. Let's read chapter 24. Now Yahweh is about to lay waste the earth and make it desolate. He will twist its surface and scatter its inhabitants. The earth shall be utterly laid waste and utterly despoiled, for Yahweh has spoken this word. The earth dries up and withers. The world languishes and withers. The heavens languish together with the earth. The earth lies polluted under its inhabitants, for they have transgressed laws, violated the statutes, and broken the everlasting covenant. After that, unexpectedly, we have a thanksgiving psalm. So it's judgmental, but always trying to keep hope alive. Here we have chapter 25, verse 1. Yahweh, you are my God in this complex world. Therein, you are my God. I will exalt you, for you have done wonderful things. Plans formed of old, faithful and sure. For you have made the fortified city a ruin. The palace of aliens is a city no more. It will never be rebuilt. Babylon is in mind, probably. Therefore, strong peoples will glorify you. Cities of ruthless nations will fear you. For you have been a refuge to the poor, a refuge to the needy in their distress. a shelter from the rainstorm and a shade from the heat. When the blast of the ruthless was like a flood pounding a wall, the noise of aliens like heat in a dry place, you subdued the heat with the shade of clouds. The song of the ruthless was stilled. Pieces of memory that raise hope and pieces of memory that seem to dash it. On this mountain, promise, on this mountain, Yahweh of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, of rich food filled with marrow, of well-aged wines strained clear. He will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast over all peoples, the sheet that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. A little line quoted by Paul in 1 Corinthians. Then the Lord Yahweh will wipe away the tears from all faces. Just a hope kind of reaching beyond experience because of their love of God and trust in Yahweh's justice. Yahweh will wipe away the tears from all faces, and the disgrace of his people he will take away from all the earth, for Yahweh has spoken. I wonder how many Jews read that kind of material in Auschwitz. So, comment, after all the talk of Yahweh's punishing Judah's enemies, this extraordinary piece is a timely reminder that punishment is always in view of bringing people to acknowledge Yahweh and to receive life from God. We are accustomed to hearing this in relation to Israel, but here the prophet is speaking, and I'm quoting from what I've just quoted, he's talking about all peoples, all nations, all faces, all the earth. The background to this text seems to be a liturgical celebration of the universal lordship of Yahweh, probably on the occasion of the pilgrimage festival of booths, or Sukkoth, tabernacles, the great Jewish, the main Jewish cultic ceremony, the New Year ceremony. Then we find another Thanksgiving psalm. It will be said on that day, this is the apocalyptic view, like whatever this day is, in history you can't see it, but surely God is going to intervene, and on that day, the day of judgment, when everything's clear, it will be said on that day, lo, this is our God. We've waited for him so that he might save us. This is Yahweh, for whom we've waited. Let us be glad and rejoice in his saving power, for the hand of Yahweh will rest on this mountain. Then, surprisingly, I find in here, chapter 25, three verses, again against Moab, the eastern country on the other side of the Jordan. I won't read that. Then a third Thanksgiving psalm. On that day, the ultimate day, the day of judgment, the day of Yahweh, on that day this song will be sung in the land of Judah. They're not singing it now, and they don't sing it under the Persians, and they don't sing it under the Greeks, and they don't sing it under the Romans. On that day, This song will be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. He sets up victory like walls and bulwarks. Open the gates so that the righteous nation that keeps faith may enter in. Those of steadfast mind, you keep in peace. In peace because they trust in you. Trust in Yahweh forever. For in Yahweh you have an everlasting rock. For he has brought low the inhabitants of the height. The lofty city he lays low. He lays it low to the ground and casts it to the dust. The foot tramples it, the feet of the poor, the steps of the needy. Then comes a section where the authors of this, inspired by what Isaiah had said centuries before, and encourage the people to keep believing that God would intervene one day. The way of the righteous is level. O just one, you make smooth, that's God of course, the path of the righteous. In the path of your judgments, Yahweh, we wait for you. Your name and your renown are the soul's desire. My soul yearns for you in the night. My spirit within me earnestly seeks you. For when your judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world learn righteousness. They learn to be wise as to what is right. The text goes on, if favor is shown to the wicked, they don't learn righteousness. In the land of uprightness, they deal perversely and do not see the majesty of Yahweh, of the Lord, of the God of the burning bush, the liberating God. Yahweh, your hand is lifted up to punish, to bring justice, but they don't see it. Let them see your zeal for your people, a plea, and be ashamed. Let the fire for your adversaries consume them. Yahweh, you will ordain peace for us, for indeed all that we have done, you have done for us. Extraordinary faith, really, in the face of terrible situations. Yahweh, our God, other lords beside you have ruled over us. But we acknowledge your name alone. The dead do not live. Shades, people living in Sheol, whom they thought were kind of existing but not alive, wispy, whatever. The dead don't live, shades don't rise, because you've punished and destroyed them and wiped out their memory forever. But it's going to be different for Israel, say these people, reaching beyond history to hope. The psalmist goes on to recall the empire of David when Yahweh, brackets, enlarged all the borders of the land. And the text reads, but you have increased the nation. Back then, Yahweh, you've increased the nation. You're glorified. You've enlarged all the borders of the land. Yahweh, in distress they sought you. They poured out a prayer when your chastening was on them. like a woman with child who writhes and cries out in her pangs when she's near her time, so were we because of you, Yahweh. We were with child. We writhed. Very powerful image here, isn't it? But we gave birth only to wind. God entrusted Israel with this mission. But we failed. We failed to do it. All we brought forth was wind. We've won no victories on earth. No one is born to inhabit the world. And then a big moment of hope. You're dead. Don't think of resurrection from the dead, perhaps, unless this could well have been written at the time of Daniel, 200 BC, that kind of period, in which case it might be picking up the beginnings of hope for resurrection from the dead. Could be. Or it might be just making this distinction between those who die from enemy countries and your dead shall rise, shall live. Their corpses shall rise. Is he speaking about the nation as a whole? Or are there beginnings of hope that death may not be the end? I don't know. Your dead shall rise. Their corpses shall live. O dwellers in the dust, awake, sing for joy. For your dew is a radiant dew, and the earth will give birth to those long dead. At least he's saying, our nation will again become great. Your nation will. He may also be having glimmers of hope of what will later be called the resurrection of the dead. Chapter 27, we're still in this special section, 24 to 27, talks about Yahweh's care for his people. It reads, a pleasant vineyard, picking up from Isaiah chapter 5, a pleasant vineyard, sing about it. I, Yahweh, am its keeper. Every moment I water it. I guard it night and day so that no one can harm it. I have no wrath. If it gives me thorns and briars, I'll march to battle against it. I'll burn it up. Or else let it cling to me for protection. Choice that's being offered to the people. Let it cling to me. Let it make peace with me. Let it make peace with me. In days to come, Jacob shall take root, Israel shall blossom and put forth shoots and fill the whole world with fruit. I have no problem imagining Paul reading that as part of his conversion experience and part of the energy that brought him to, in his view, be faithful to this tradition, to the Abram becoming the father of many nations and to the whole mission given to the people of God to take it to the world. And that's what the early Jewish Christian community with such energy believed and took. The whole world will be filled with fruit. Chapter 27:7 talks about the exile will purify the people. I'll leave you to read that yourself because I can't do the whole verse. Then there's a section which concludes this, Isaiah 27:12-13. It reads, on that day, this is apocalyptic material, on that day, Yahweh will thresh from the channel of the Euphrates to the Wadi of Egypt. And you will be gathered one by one, O people of Israel. On that day, a great trumpet will be blown, and those who were lost in the land of Assyria and those who are driven out to the land of Egypt will come and worship on the holy mountain of Jerusalem. Chapter 28 talks about the fall. We're back now in another section altogether, back to Isaiah. It's the fall of Samaria in 721 BC. And in that section, Isaiah is making the point that the dangerously foolish policies, so we're back with Isaiah now, the dangerously foolish policies that brought about the fall of Israel, the northern kingdom, are the kinds of policies that are being followed by the Jerusalem court. They'll have the same outcome, Isaiah can see. Verse 1 to 4 paint a picture of a regime that's living in luxury, totally oblivious of the destructive storm that God is gathering to bring about their destruction. The rich and the powerful, yes, but unfortunately when the rich and the powerful are destroyed, the whole country is destroyed. The beautiful garland that is Ephraim, what we'll call Samaria later, the beautiful garland that is Ephraim is like the garland on the head of a senseless drunkard at a funeral banquet. They don't seem to realize in all their celebration and all this that they're celebrating the death of all that they hold dear. So let's look at some of this. Isaiah proclaims to his contemporaries in Jerusalem and Judah, "Ah, the proud garland of the drunkards of Ephraim." Samaria, the town, is the capital of Ephraim. "And the fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is on the head of those bloated with rich food, of those overcome with wine. See, the Lord has one who is mighty and strong, like a storm of hail, a destroying tempest, like a storm of mighty overflowing waters. With his hand he will hurl them to the earth. Trampled underfoot will be the proud garland of the drunkards of Ephraim. And the fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is on the head of those bloated with rich food, will be like the first ripe fig before the summer. Whoever sees it, eats it up as soon as it comes to hand. All tables will be covered with filthy vomit. No place is clean. Whom will he teach knowledge? And to whom will he explain the message? Those who are weaned from milk, those taken from the breast? For it is," I'll help you in a minute with this, I hope, because of itself it's a bit unintelligible. He's talking about what people are saying, what they're all shouting, what they're singing, what the prophets, so-called, up there in Samaria, etc. "For it's precept upon precept, precept after precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little, there a little." So let me try the Hebrew on you. These are English letters. In other words, it's all gibberish. They're all blah, 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 but they're not getting to the point of it. And it reads something like this. Tso la tso, tso la tso, kao la kao, kao la kao, ze'eu sham, ze'eu sham. The priests and the prophets in Samaria are just talking gibberish. They're repeating themselves. They're saying what they said last week in the pulpit, but they've got nothing to do with what's really going on. They're giving legitimation to the policies favoured by the court, and the rich and the mighty are, inverted commas, enjoying themselves why their country is about to be ruined. Comment. People have a right to hear from the priests the law of God. That's their duty. They have a right to hear from the prophets words learned in prayer and communicated humbly and rightly, whatever the cost to the prophets. But, in Isaiah's opinion, both priest and prophet are providing religious legitimation for the policies favoured by the court. All the people get is the kind of repetition that one expects in a kindergarten. In fact, it'll get worse. All they'll hear is the sound of a foreign and unintelligible tongue, a Syrian army. Yahweh wanted the people to enjoy rest, secure possession of the land and freedom from external threat, but they wouldn't listen. Isaiah 28:11, truly with stammering lip and alien tongue, he will speak to this people, to whom he has said, this is rest, give rest to the weary, and this is repose. God keeps showing them how to find rest, then put us in there, of course, and he's showing the weary how to get repose. But, says Isaiah, they wouldn't listen. Paul's totally familiar with all this. In fact, quotes it in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. Therefore, he repeats, the word of Yahweh that should be in red, this, therefore the word of Yahweh will be for them, tso la tso, tso la tso, kao la kao, kao la kao, ze'el sham, ze'el sham. Meaningless. It's not getting through. No one understands it. And everyone's just hurtling on their way to destruction. And Isaiah continues, in order that they may go and fall backward, and be broken, snared, and taken into exile. Therefore, says Isaiah to his contemporaries in Judah, as he's watching all this happen up the north, therefore hear the word of Yahweh, you scoffers who rule the people in Jerusalem. Okay, we're talking about Samaria, fine. What about us? It's no better here. Because you said, we've made a covenant with death, that's Egypt, and with Sheol we have an agreement. When the overwhelming scourge passes through, it won't come to us. For we've made lies our refuge, and in falsehood we've taken shelter. Could we put for falsehood? Fake news. So they're relying on false visions of prophets, inverted commas, who tell them what they want to hear. The only true shelter is Yahweh. And Isaiah continues, therefore, thus says the Lord Yahweh, see, I am laying in Zion. Zion is Jerusalem, but it's Jerusalem is a place. It's physical, like Sydney is or Campbelltown. When it's talking about the geographical city, that's what they call it. When they use the word Zion, it overlays it with deep theological meaning. Zion is Jerusalem as the place of the Davidic king and as the place of the temple, God's dwelling. So it's got rich religious significance. I'm laying in Zion a stone, a massive stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation, and I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the plumb line. That's quoted throughout the New Testament. In Romans, Peter, Matthew, Ephesians, Timothy. So obviously they're drawing on this material and finding in Isaiah stuff to make judgments of their own New Testament situation. Isaiah chapter 29 talks about the siege of Jerusalem. I haven't time to read it to you. You can read it yourself should you wish. And then goes on to talk about the fact, and once again, that they're unwilling to see. And here's Isaiah. Stupefy yourselves. Go and get drunk, in other words. Be in a stupor. Blind yourselves. Go on, be blind, people, says Isaiah. Be drunk, but not with wine. Stagger, but not from strong drink. For Yahweh has poured out upon you a spirit of deep sleep. Yahweh's behind everything. People are asleep. So Yahweh must, according to Isaiah's understanding, Yahweh must be intending that for some purpose. He's closed your eyes, you prophets, and covered your heads with, so you seers, so you can't see. You're not listening and you're not in touch, so you're asleep. That's quoted by Paul in Romans. And Isaiah goes on, Yahweh said, because these people draw near me, this is Isaiah's judgment, inspired by his prayer. These people draw near me with their mouths. Not the right words. They honour me with their lips. But their hearts are far from me. And their worship of me is a human commandment learned by rote. Quoted, as you know, in Mark chapter 7 and in Colossians chapter 2. So, says Isaiah, speaking for Yahweh, I will again do marvelous things with these people, shocking and amazing, and the discernment of the discerning will be hidden. They won't see what's really happening. That's quoted in by Paul. Isaiah 29:15 reads, Ha, you who hide a plan too deep for Yahweh, whose deeds are in the dark, who say, Who sees us? Who knows us? You turn things upside down. Shall the potter be regarded as a clay? Are you manipulating God? Shall the thing made say to its maker, Oh, he didn't make me. There's no God. Quoted by Paul again. Or the thing formed say to the one who forms it, He doesn't know what he's doing. Shall not Lebanon in a very little while become a fruitful field, and the fruitful field be as common as forest? On that day, the deaf shall hear the words of a scroll, and out of their gloom and darkness the eyes of the blind shall see. The lowly shall obtain fresh joy in Yahweh. On that day, the day of the judgment, the lowly shall obtain fresh joy in Yahweh, and the neediest people shall exult in the Holy One of Israel. for the tyrant shall be no more, and the scoffer shall cease to be. All those alert to do evil will be cut off. Those who cause a person to lose a lawsuit, who set a trap for the arbiter in the gate, and without grounds deny justice to the one who's in the right. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 1 to 7, talks about the folly of aligning himself with Israel, with Egypt, because Egypt's the weaker partner that's going to bring the Assyrians right in. Then Isaiah goes on to talk about keeping the prophecy for future generations. People aren't listening now, but write it down, and the scribes copy it, so that one day we'll have it and be able to value it. Then there's a section on an ignominious defeat that's going to await them. And in chapter 30, verse 18, Isaiah writes, "Therefore, Yahweh waits to be gracious to you. Therefore, he will rise up to show mercy to you. For Yahweh is a God of justice. Blessed are all those who wait for him." Then comes a text which seems to be from later to kind of spell this out a bit more. Chapter 30, verse 19 and the following reads, "Truly, O people in Zion, inhabitants of Jerusalem, you shall weep no more." Not based on historical evidence, but based on trust that God will eventually bring about justice somehow. "He will surely be gracious to you at the sound of your cry. When he hears it, he will answer you. Though the Lord may give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teacher will not hide himself any more, but your eyes shall see your teacher. And when you turn to the right or when you turn to the left, your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, 'This is the way, walk in it.'" I'm sure you can hear the early Christian Jews reading this with and seeing Jesus as the way and the teacher who points the way, is Torah, of course, the way. "This is the way, walk in it. Then you will defile your silver-covered idols and your gold-plated images. You'll scatter them like filthy rags. You'll say to them, 'Away with you,' on the day when Yahweh heals the wounds inflicted by his blow." There follows in chapter 30 a statement on the end of Assyria. It won't be there forever. And then there's a section 31 on relying on Yahweh rather than Egypt. And then there's a painting, a portrait of the ideal ruler in Isaiah 32, followed by a summons to mourn, promising that things will change. And here we have in chapter 32:15, Isaiah, "A spirit from on high will be poured out on us, and the wilderness becomes a fruitful field, and the fruitful field is deemed a forest. Then justice will dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness abide in the fruitful field. The effect of righteousness will be peace, and the result of righteousness, quiet and trust forever. My people will abide in a peaceful habitation, in secure dwellings, in quiet resting places. You might think of Psalm 23, the shepherd, etc. Yahweh, Isaiah prays in 33:2, Yahweh, be gracious to us. We wait for you. Be our arm. Arm is the arm of the conqueror. Be our arm every morning, our salvation in the time of trouble. Chapter 33:14, how does one avoid this judgment that all can see is happening? Well, this is what he says. Who among us can live with the devouring fire? That's not a lovely idea. That's fire ripping through, fire, setting fire to the city, destructive fire. Who among us can live with everlasting flames? Here's his reply. Those who walk righteously, speak uprightly, who despise the gain of oppression, who wave away a bribe instead of accepting it, who stop their ears from hearing of bloodshed and shut their eyes from looking on evil, they will live on the heights. Their refuge will be the fortresses of rocks. Their food will be supplied and their water assured. Your eyes will see the King in his beauty. They will behold a land that stretches far away, the promised land. No longer will you see the insolent people, the people of an obscure speech that you cannot comprehend, stammering in a language that you cannot understand. Your eyes will see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation, an immovable tent whose stakes will never be pulled up, and none of those whose ropes will be broken. But there Yahweh in majesty will be for us a place of broad rivers and streams where no galley with oars can go, safe against the enemy. And we come now to the last section of the Isaiah scroll. Not the scroll, but the section that comes from Isaiah the prophet. Isaiah 35-39 was composed after the exile to link the section we've done from 1-34 with the writings of the Isaiah school in exile. They're going to put the Isaiah, I'll call it the Isaiah school for the moment, in exile. They're going to put that into the scroll so they make some links to prepare for us so that it can fit. And I'll just read little bits of it for you. Isaiah 35 verse 3 reads, strengthen the weak hands, make firm the feeble knees, quoted by the author of the letter to the Hebrews. Say to those who are of fearful heart, be strong, don't be afraid. Here is your God. He will come with vengeance, with terrible recompense. He'll come and save you. Then, this is quoted in Matthew chapter 11, Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened. And that's how the disciples of Jesus saw what he was doing. He's the leader we've been waiting for. He's the Messiah. He's the anointed one. The eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the speechless sing for joy. Quoted by Jesus when the disciples of John the Baptist said, "Are you the one or aren't you the one?" For, Isaiah continues, waters shall break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand will become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. The haunt of jackals shall become a swamp, and the grass shall become reeds and rushes. A highway shall be there, and it shall be called the Holy Way. The unclean shall not travel on it. It shall be for God's people. No traveller, not even the foolish, will go astray. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come up upon it. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there, and the ransomed of Yahweh shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. And to conclude, the last four chapters, 36, 7, 8 and 9, is a historical appendix. I won't do any of it with you. It includes a prayer of Hezekiah, but apart from that, word for word, is found in the second book of Kings, chapter 18 to chapter 20. So it's a piece of historical material put in here to kind of link it back to history. And these four chapters, this appendix to the Isaiah material, deals with Hezekiah's role in forming an anti-Assyrian alliance, which included Egypt. It talks about the campaign of Sennacherib, the devastation of Judah, the siege of Jerusalem, and the situation in Judah after the lifting of the siege. It's attempting to link to where we're going to go when I come back with you at quarter past 11, where we're going to look at a whole new section, 115 more years after the time of Isaiah. A group of people in exile are going to draw on their faith to encourage people, encourage us.